welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
Welcome to Syosset Library's Turn the Page podcast. I am Jessica, one of your hosts. I am here with my co-host,
Jen. Hello.
And we are here with an author from across the pond who has written a book that has made all of our 80s childhood dreams come true. Would you like to introduce yourself and talk a bit about this book?
Sure. Hi, thank you so much for having me. It's really great to be here. I am Josh Winning, and I am the author of The Shadow Glass, which is my sort of loving, nostalgic adventure, very much inspired by 1980s fantasy films like The Dark Crystal and Labyrinth and The Neverending Story.
Yeah, my first, you know, I'm looking at like at my notes here really quickly, and the thing that I have like on top is a love letter to fans of Henson, Dark Crystal, Dark Children's Media. And really, why did the children's media from the 70s to early 90s want to traumatize children? And maybe we're better for it. What's your thought, Jen?
Yeah, I think the 80s produced a lot of like really unique properties for children. And this was just such a beautiful celebration, you know, of that period in children's entertainment.
That's so great. Thank you so much. Yeah, I think that the 80s definitely birthed a lot of nightmares for like our generation. But I think that's kind of okay. Like, didn't Jim Henson say something like, I don't think children should feel safe 100% of the time. Like, he wanted us to experience the full spectrum of emotion, all the way from sort of the joy of friendship through to the horror of, you know, terrible things happening. And I think The Dark Crystal specifically is very dark. It deals in themes that are sort of probably beyond the reach of a lot of sort of like 8, 9, 10 year olds. You know, it's about gentrification, it's about industrialization, it's about the split nature of identity. Like, it's just shocking to me that this film kind of exists, and I love that it exists because it's just so profound and amazing. And I think that's probably why it had such a deep and lasting effect on me, and certainly lots of people who have remained fans of it decades later.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, and Jen and myself are big fans of Fraggle Rock, which while it's not as dark as Dark Crystal at all. However, I know we've talked about this a few times that it you know, they were being produced around the same time, and it all sort of, they both do center around different factions of society being reliant on a similar source. I guess for Fraggles, it was radishes, and for the Dark Crystal, it was the Dark Crystal. But Fraggles did not have like the Gorgs got better. They did not like suck the life out of like Boober by showing him a giant radish. So the story is from the point of view of Jack, who is the son of a Henson-like person who made a movie called The Shadow Glass, which is sort of an amalgam of a bunch of movies such as Dark Crystal and The Neverending Story. And he's very bitter. And this, it just like, talk to us about it, because I have so many thoughts.
Sure. I think Jack was the reason that I ended up wanting to write the story. You know, I originally had this idea about wanting to write a puppet fantasy book years before I even started thinking about The Shadow Glass. And it just kind of, this idea of doing a puppet story just sort of hung in the back of my mind for years. And I didn't really, it didn't solidify into anything actually worthy of telling until I discovered Jack. And that was basically because I was kind of rereading up around Labyrinth and just remembering how actually it was deemed a commercial failure. You know, it cost millions to make, and it made not that many millions back when it was in cinemas. And I kind of remember feeling this like deep sadness for Jim Henson, because it ended up being his last movie that he made. He sadly passed away, I think it was 3 or 4 years later, for health reasons. He wasn't that old, but he kind of died having made a commercial failure. But in my eyes, it's one of my Labyrinth is one of my absolute favorite films and is nothing but a triumph. And so this idea of perceived failure sort of really struck a chord with me. And so that became my way into telling a story about puppets, basically. And yeah, so Jack is kind of like the son of this director who kind of not only is perceived as a failure, but perceives himself as a failure. And that is the reason that their relationship fell apart. You know, it fragmented their relationship completely. And so Jack, his story is very much about sort of trying to understand his father, who has now passed away, while also rediscovering his love for the film The Shadow Glass, which in his mind has come to represent everything that he hates about his father.
Yeah, something that I thought the book captured really poignantly was the pain of being hurt by somebody who the entire world, you know, loves, and, you know, sort of like the legacy of dysfunctional families and the complicated status of our heroes. You know, they're very rarely like purely unadulterated heroes. And yeah, I was wondering about like, you know, what were your thoughts behind that in crafting the kind of the dynamic between father and son, and like son and his father's properties and stuff like that?
Yeah, that is a big question. I wish I knew. I wish I could give you like a really sort of eloquent, perfect answer for that. I think that I just love complex family dynamics. I find them fascinating. Definitely, I was thinking about my own relationship with my father, and, you know, sort of the complexities that exist there, you know, for various reasons. And actually, I think around the time I started writing this, I was spending a lot of time with my dad, because his wife was sort of had cancer and she was dying, essentially, and she did pass away a couple of years ago, 3 years ago. And so I think I was just very much thinking about father-son relationships and the emotions tied up in all of that. And yeah, I think that definitely fed into Jack and his father for sure. Yeah. Yeah, I think families are endlessly fascinating and infuriating, and sort of, but if you're lucky, they're always there for you. And in The Shadow Glass, I think I had fun playing around with perhaps Bob's perspective of this relationship and the story of their relationship and Jack's perspective on it, and kind of trying to figure out the muddy part where the truth actually lies in the middle of all that.
So you do a lot of work around different types of families. There's, you know, the actual blood family of Jack and his father, which is complicated, but then Jack has a cousin who's now working for his father's company, which further complicates things. And then you have the people who were involved in the production of The Shadow Glass to begin with, such as Jenny and some of the others who were, you know, puppeteers or, you know, worked with him. But then you also have like a family of fans. And one of the things I absolutely adored about this book is how much it really embraced what can be positive in fandom. There's a lot also that talks about fan entitlement, which I thought was an interesting direction as well. But you have, you know, somebody like Toby, which, by the way, nice nod to Labyrinth, who is a huge fan of Jack's father and all of his work, who has a very different relationship with it than Jack. He has the fan relationship, and the two of them, in a way, work separately, but end up working together. And then we haven't even gotten into the Ketu and the Scallions, who are the characters within the Shadow Glass who come to life. Dune being the hero of the Shadow Glass, like a fox-like anthropomorphic creature, is not necessarily the central character. So spoiler alert for those who did not read the back of the book or might not imagine from what we've been talking about, the characters from the Shadow Glass and Eerie, which is, I guess, the world of the Shadow Glass, begin to come to life and interact with Jack because the stakes are really high in both our world and theirs. And you meet Zavanna, who actually is the sister of Dune. So again, that's another relationship.
Yeah, definitely. I think Zavanna kind of ended up representing a more of like a romantic kind of relationship, like hopefully not in like a too creepy kind of way. She kind of represented like the possibility of opening yourself up to another person slash creature. And that's something that Jack has very much failed to do. You know, he, again, failure, like he's obsessed with this idea of failure. And so he hasn't committed to anything. He hasn't committed to anything work-wise, relationship-wise. And because he's afraid of it, he's afraid that if you pour your heart into something, it can destroy you. And so when Zavanna comes along, she, by the very nature of her personality, sort of confronts him with all of this unspoken stuff that he's been doing and won't stand for it, basically. She kind of calls him a man-child. She says that he's basically an idiot. And he kind of has to earn her respect. And they end up, spoiler, but they end up sort of on a different footing than they did at the beginning of the story.
Something that I really loved about, some of the elements that you've just been talking about is the way they speak to kind of the dialectical nature between the artist and the art that they create. So I thought it was super interesting the way that, you know, Bob, Jack's father, put all of his, his life experiences and his relationships into crafting Eerie and its characters, especially Dune sort of being like a reflection of Jack as a child and, you know, Bob's image of his son. But then the way that sort of like the creation also speaks back to the creator and starts to shape them in turn. Like, I thought that was a very interesting, dynamic to explore.
Oh, that's awesome. I'm so pleased. It's, it's an idea that, I'm a jobbing journalist. My day job is working as a film journalist. So I've been very lucky to have visited the sets of certain movies and TV shows like Game of Thrones and Muppets Most Wanted and stuff like that. So I've seen how much goes into the creation of this one thing. And so it didn't really feel right that Bob was the sole reason for this thing to exist. It had to be like the pieces of the Dark Crystal, the shards. You know, it's kind of like lots of different pieces working together to create this one thing. And so that was definitely in my mind, was it, the creator isn't God. It's the creator is somebody who almost like accidentally does something. Like, I often feel like when I've finished a book, I've done it by accident, and it's not purely my creation. Like, I can look at the Shadow Glass and there are elements in it that are from my partner, there are elements from my editor, and you know, that they all helped make it the best version of this thing that just happened to be an idea that I had at the start of it.
So this book gets very, very meta, and I absolutely adore it. And another thing I had written in my notes is that this is the book we all need. And I don't know if I meant children who were traumatized by their 80s media or just fans in general. I think, you mentioned how much of a quote unquote flop these movies were, but these are some of the biggest properties. I think I mentioned before this interview that I thought that the Dark Crystal Age of resilience, it could pretty much be the same thing, right? Was absolutely brilliant and just sort of reawakened a lot of feelings. When you were thinking meta for this book, did you ever get to a point where you were like, this might be a bridge too far? Did you have any boundaries?
Did I have any boundaries? I think I was very conscious of not ripping things off. And that would have been very easy to do. So I wanted to find ways to sort of authentically and organically fold in certain references from films like The Dark Crystal and Neverending Story in a way that sort of didn't feel like I was ripping them off. Like, hopefully they feel like they are a fabric of this universe, and they're kind of, they're there if people know those properties, and they kind of pick up on those references. They can almost be like Easter eggs. I mean, to me, they're super obvious Easter eggs, but they're there. And to people who haven't seen those films, then I guess it's just sort of like another thing that happens in the book. that's part of the reason, like you mentioned, that this is for us. That's exactly why I wrote the book. I kind of have this longing and this real sort of almost grief for the fact that nobody's making these films anymore. You know, we have sequels to Star Wars, and they are sort of going back to more animatronic and puppetry for characters, but nobody is just making a standalone fantasy with puppets anymore, apart from, obviously, we had, as you mentioned, the Dark Crystal Netflix show, which then got cancelled, which is so upsetting and actually quite shocking, because they've built everything, can't they just carry it on? Apparently not. This book, I essentially wrote it for everybody and anybody who loves those films and just wishes there were more of them.
That that speaks directly to a point in a question that I had been thinking about while I was reading this, that there are so many ways in which this book is about sort of like a bygone era and lost media and lost mediums for art, because you have like sort of like the celebration of practical effects over, you know, what would be CGI these days. There's like a wonderful scene that takes place in a video rental store that stocks VHS tapes instead of DVDs. And that was where my question kind of lie, because when I was a child in the late 80s and early 90s, video rental stores were sacred places. Like, they were absolutely important in my early life, and they determined like my development as a fan of film and of nerd culture and sci-fi and fantasy. And I was wondering if you had a personal relationship with that too.
Absolutely. Yeah, that the video shop in the Shadow Glass book is completely based on the video shop of my childhood. Unbelievably, it still exists. It's like a tiny independent store in my hometown in the middle of nowhere in Suffolk. And I walked past it a couple of months ago. It's still there. They do sadly now have DVDs rather than videos, but I'm very gratified to say that they still have they've given prominent place for The Neverending Story, Dark Crystal, Labyrinth, Flight of the Navigator. So even though they're now doing DVDs rather than videos, they are still supporting all these great 80s films. It must be some kind of crusade. I don't know who the owner is, but it must be some kind of crusade, and I applaud and salute them. that video shop was instrumental, I would say, in me discovering all of these films. I've got very, very blurry memories of going to that shop with my dad and just feeling like you were in the candy store, looking at all these amazing covers, all these worlds to be discovered, and, you know, getting to take them home and watch them over and over and over again, and then go back the next week and find more worlds to discover. And I think that there is a loss of that sense of discovery. And it's in some ways, it's brilliant that these films are now so readily available. You can just pop onto any of the streaming services pretty much and either rent them, buy them, or they're there on subscription. And that's great because it means people can just watch them with minimal effort. But at the same time, there's just something kind of a bit soulless about scrolling through a bunch of posters and going, "Oh, right, I'll shove that on." You don't have that tangible feeling of magic that you get from actually picking up something and wanting to sort of get inside of it.
So Toby and his gaming / Shadowglass fan friends have a really nice dynamic. And again, I mention on the other side of the coin, there is the fans that feel like they really do own this property and can gatekeep what people like and what people don't like, which is very much how I feel reality is within different factions of fandom. Did you feel kind of like you needed to tell both sides of the story, both kind and maybe not so kind?
Yeah, I guess that for me, Toby, who's like the super fan, in like kind of like quite a cute, excitable kind of way. Then you have Wesley Cutter, who's the sort of, he calls himself the keeper of Eerie because he thinks that he's preserving the integrity of the original film. And so I guess I wanted those two characters to almost represent the two halves of Jack. And he kind of has, he's kind of essentially become a version of Cutter in some ways, in that he isn't looking to preserve it. He basically wants to destroy the Shadowglass. He wishes it never existed. And so it's almost sort of like opportune that he meets Toby first, because Toby almost gives him or offers him like a potential new way of looking at the film. What helps him remember what it was like when he loved it as a child. And, you know, you kind of think, well, what would happen actually if Cutter had turned up in his front garden first? You know, maybe would have had a much different story. And I didn't really set out intending to comment on fandom, but I just think that the nature of the story just naturally followed that path, I guess. And I didn't really want to like condemn anybody, or, you know, I didn't really want to get into that kind of like internet troll debate kind of thing. But I think maybe certain people would see that in there. I don't know. Or maybe they won't. Maybe that's the problem. I don't know. Maybe nobody thinks they're Cutter. You know, people on the internet who are very vocal, they probably wouldn't think that they were Cutter. And that's fine, I guess, to each their own.
Absolutely. Yeah, and that reminds me too about like, you know, Cutter is about like, you know, sort of like the more toxic parts of fandom, but also about parasocial relationships, you know, and that's something that we've really only have been discussing in the last few years, but has probably been around as a phenomenon for much longer. And just sort of the way that like, you know, we are capable of developing these one-sided relationships with celebrities or creators that then create almost a sense of entitlement and an illusion of there being a two-way relationship where one doesn't exist.
Mm. Yeah, that's interesting. I've never heard that term before, parasocial.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's actually a lot of people are talking about it with relation to like Twitter and TikTok and the way that people develop one-sided relationship with these internet celebrities, but that are sort of like can be healthy, and they can be, you know, a part of like a healthy kind of social arrangement, but also they can get a little bit toxic, you know, and sort of create a sense of entitlement in people where they think that they deserve access to a person, you know. And I feel like that's a lot of that is kind of at work in Wesley. He feels like he is entitled not only to a say in Bob's creation and sort of how Eerie develops and is policed as a property, but then also like he feels like he's entitled to Bob's time as well, you know?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I suppose, yeah, that is quite interesting, because obviously a relationship is always two ways, and if it's not two ways, that's when it goes bad, I suppose. So yeah, I could definitely see that. That's really interesting. I hadn't really thought of that, but yeah, interesting.
So the characters that come from Erie, so I mentioned before, there's the Ketu, there are the Scallions, and then there's, is it Kunin Yilda?
Kunin Yilda, yeah.
Wow. Where did she come from?
I guess it was only sort of like later that I was trying to sum up to people what's going on there. And she basically is like Miss Piggy crossed with Hannibal Lecter. So she's sort of bonkers, self-involved, completely entitled, and actually really dangerous. And so I kind of just loved the idea of creating a villain who's just unapologetically nasty to the core. There's nothing good going on there. The only glimpse of sort of humanity in her is the fact that she's sort of a bit conscious of her appearance. Like she's kind of like quite preening, and if you call her ugly, then oh my god, that's the worst thing that you could ever say to her. That's actually awful.
That's the Piggy in her, right?
Exactly, that's the Miss Piggy.
Yeah,
exactly. So I think I was kind of thinking about Skeletor in Masters of the Universe, where I just love Frank Langella as Skeletor. Is one of the absolute joys of my life. I could watch him do that over and over and over again. And he's just, there's no real depth other than he wants power and he'll do anything to get it. You have no idea what he would do with that power once he had it. Probably not anything particularly good, but that is Kunin Yilda. She just wants power. She'll do whatever she can to get it. You know, bad things are going to happen if she does get it. So, yeah.
So I'm sure you are aware, because we have mentioned the Neverending Story several times, that there is a connection between Skeletor in the Masters of the Universe TV series and Neverending Story.
Ah, the new series or the original?
The TV series. So Skeletor is voiced by Alan Oppenheimer, who is also Falcor Gamorg, the
rock writer.
Yeah, the,
oh, the narrator.
Narrator, yeah. Pretty much everybody.
I did not know that. That's amazing. I love it.
I find it so exciting. And I have to say, so I found out about that originally. I was at a Comic-Con nearby, and I saw him, he was there, and I saw just like the characters that he voices behind him, and I was like, how is that possible? How is Skeletor and Falcor the same person? And also, if you're interested, if you look him up on YouTube, you can actually, he does like a series of reading Skeletor memes in Skeletor's voice, and it's glorious. But then I forgot about it for a while, and then a few years later, I think it was like about a year and a half ago, we were recording here something with the podcaster Sarah Marshall about the Neverending Story, and I found out again, and I was like, how did I forget that? And also, what?
Sometimes facts like that are just too enormous for your brain to actually hold. You just almost can't believe that they're real. So that makes sense.
Yeah, really just, I was just absolutely amazed by that. But I think that those are some of the connections. You know, He-Man was like my jam when I was a kid as well. So.
Yeah, I love that film. I've watched it again recently. Because I've got a podcast called Torn Stubs where we're actually doing a whole season on 80s fantasy films. And so we watched Masters of the Universe for that. And yeah, I just love it. And, you know, I kind of can't see any faults, actually. I know that people kind of can, and that's fine. You do you. But I actually think it's one of those perfect films because it's made with such love. And you can be so cynical about this stuff. You can go, it's based on a toy line, blah, blah, blah. But at the same time, I feel like they're doing such fun stuff in there, and it's made by people who love this genre, and that's okay.
You know, talking about these sort of villains and Kun and Yilda, again, to bring it back there, there is something that's like incredibly 80s about her as a villain. Like, she's just about like getting access to raw power and resources and accumulating as much as you can, and just like endless greed. And, you know, I found it very refreshing. This is something I think about a lot, probably too much, but, you know, all of our sort of modern villains that have come like sort of out of the Marvel era are all sort of like, you know, they have some like higher purpose that is like on a surface level is like a worthy or noble goal, but then they just go about it in a completely evil and thoughtless way. So that there's something really refreshing to me about a villain that's just like, I'm just evil and I love being evil, you know?
It's really freeing. And I guess that, yeah, like you're right. A lot of the Marvel villains are sort of, they have a plan, and you can, it's like when they say, if you're writing a book, then you're struggling with the villain, write about their character, write their character's sort of monologue where they are the hero of this story. And I think that Kun and Yilda probably could do that. It would be a very short story. It basically just says mine, 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 gobble, 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 you know, but I think that that is really, yeah, it was so freeing. I was like, she doesn't need to have that much depth. For a start, she's a puppet. And even though in her world, she is a real living, breathing creature, you know, I just thought, screw it. I'm just going to make her into this nasty, irredeemable piece of work. And hopefully people will enjoy that.
Yeah, Jen, you bring up a really good point there, because I mean, I'm a fan of, you know, like the depth of like villains as well. Like, for instance, Magneto, when you first find out that he is a child who survived the Holocaust, it really sort of brought a different thought process to a villain being a villain. We need that. But at the same time, you know, sometimes your 80s loving mind, or just like in general, your mind, you know, to sort of process things, needs something that is just what it is on the surface. And that's very, again, like you mentioned, very 80s. I think what I liked also about the Shadow Glass is you have a lot of like, quote unquote, editorials in it, you know, pieces looking at the picture from a historical or film angle. And I think somebody compares her to Gordon Gekko. So, you know, you need your Magnetos and you need your Lokis, but you also need your Gordon Geckos and your Gremlins, which, by the way, is Gremlins a children's movie? What? Like, what's your thought on that?
Absolutely.
Right? It totally is. It's
perfect. Is it rated R in the US and 15 in the UK, I think, maybe?
I don't know. I think the first one might have come out before PG-13 was a thing. And this sort of plays into movies like, quote unquote, The Shadow Glass and The Dark Crystal, and a lot of these movies that are rated PG, like the first Ghostbusters of the time, that PG-13 was not invented until the later 80s. So a lot of movies, like for instance, The Goonies, which I do love for all of the issues that it does have, was PG. So from a library standpoint, for a while we had it in the children's room, and not thinking about how freaky it was at points, one of the mothers came up to me and said, you know, I love this movie, I'm not criticizing whatever, and I realize it's rated PG, but you realize that the kids drop the S-bomb several times. And I was like, oh yeah, they do. And, you know, I'm like, yeah, this movie really would have been PG-13 had it come out, or Spielberg would have cut that language to make sure it stays PG. So we have it over in the adult section now, even though essentially it is a kid's movie.
I feel that we should safeguard children from sort of mature content, but at the same time, go on TikTok. So many people are filming their toddlers saying shit and F and all this, you know. It's like,
Oh man.
It's out there. Yeah. You can't prevent it. It's going to happen.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that that's the reason this book is for adults. You know, I kind of wasn't sure if it should be YA or not, and I really went back and forth with that. But in the end, I just had to stick to my guns and say, it's not a book for kids. It's a book for people like me in their mid to late 30s who know all this stuff. And you know, those films were dark. So what's the adult version of that darkness? It's going to be some blood and guts and a bit of nastiness. So that's why it's an adult book. And hopefully that comes across.
And I think another important thing to note is, a lot of the creators of these movies were processing trauma of their parents, trauma of, having come out of World War II, the never-ending story from the creator who didn't love the movie. And, you know, it was a very personal book, and I can't fault him for it, even though, you know, I adored the movie. The creator wrote the book to process his own trauma of growing up in Nazi Germany. And then Wolfgang Petersen, who directed the movie, also directed Das Boot. And there is a lot of these really dark children's movies that were around when we were kids that were, again, partially the result of people processing their own trauma and sort of trying to absorb the fact that these atrocities happened. And I think there's something very beautiful about that.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, that's a really good point. I was talking to my friend about this a couple of weeks ago, and we were thinking about, okay, let's look at these 80s fantasy films. They were being made by people in their 30s and 40s. So they were the children of like the war generations. And if you look at Labyrinth, Flight of the Navigator, I guess a little bit, and like Neverending Story, you know, there really is this lack of parental figures and lack of fathers, and the like Labyrinth, especially if you look at the pictures that Sarah has on her mirror, that's her basically coming to terms with this relationship that her mother had with her co-star in a play. You know, it's all subtext, but it is in there. I think that maybe that is what is so profound about these films, is that they really do tap into these dark emotions. And it does feel almost like therapy. Like, I definitely view writing as therapy. If I'm not writing anything, I start to get really like antsy and sort of like irritable. And it's because I need that outlet. I think that it's creation, you know, out of adversity, you can create something beautiful.
So I guess like my last question is, are we going to see more of Eerie ever? Do you have, I know you had spoken about, things being a standalone. Would you ever revisit the world of Eerie, or is that for the fans to revisit or visit?
That's a good point. I never set out with this thinking I would write a sequel. I've been kind of surprised actually by the characters that have resonated with people, with readers. You know, I've noticed some reviewers talking about Toby and Hugh and wanting to see more of that relationship, which kind of surprised me. I guess I think they're great as well, but I never really thought they were like the linchpin of the book. maybe fan fiction could continue that. I don't know. I never say never. I love a sequel. I do love continuing stories. But any sort of like little brain fart ideas that I have for a potential sequel aren't yet sort of coherent enough to actually form a proper story, I think. And I'm kind of proud of this thing in itself now. I worked so hard on this book. So many people worked so hard on this book. And I kind of don't want to mess it up now. So we'll see.
This has been great. Read The Shadow Glass. You're going to love it if you are a fan of any of these movies, if you are a film historian, if you are a fan in general. This is just a love letter to people of our generation and people who really want to live fantasy and don't want to see that part of themselves die. So once again, this was Jessica with Syosset Libraries Turn the Page podcast. My co-host was
Jen.
And our guest today was
Josh Winning.
And we are going to close this chapter of Turn the Page.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.